Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. Now, I have a particular interest in this one, as I've been a customer of this man for a few years and can categorise it as a learning from COVID for me. Sustainable Seafood Ireland was set up in 2013 by owner Niall Sabongi. As a chef and restaurant owner, Niall initially wanted to supply his growing restaurant business, but more importantly, have a better understanding of where his seafood came from and if it was truly sustainable. Allied to that, he also wanted top quality, variety of species, access to fish and shellfish that often only gets exported. So having the opportunity to build direct links with the fishers and boats was a big driving force in setting up the business. In late 2014, Sustainable Seafood Ireland was approached by a number of other restaurants and like-minded chefs in the business seeking the same quality and variety. They get their seafood from a close network of purveyors and fishermen using world-class standards to help ensure transparency at every step. From the waters the fish are harvested in, the catch method, down to the boat and the skippers, letting them enjoy it with confidence and share this first-hand knowledge with their customers. Niall, you're very welcome to today's podcast.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you here. So let's start off with an easy one for you, right? Why is sustainability so important to you?
Sustainability is so important to me. I suppose it's important to everybody. I grew up around the sea, around the coast of Dublin. I spend, if I'm not working or with my family, I'm in the water, be it swimming, sailing, or you know, scuba diving, or what it is. So I've always been very connected and linked in with the water and with just marine life in general. So it was always it's also just something that's I've just been very passionate about. All through my life, and I suppose it accidentally kind of. Because, you know, SSI is a accidental business. It wasn't ever an intention for it to be a business or to have such a focus on sustainability. It was just a natural growth thing for me.
And you know, in that regard, then when you look at SSI, how important is to have that kind of clarity of purpose behind it? Because anybody could be a fish merchant. Do you know what I mean?
Anybody could be a fish merchant. Absolutely. And I suppose the importance of clarity. I suppose it comes back every day. Hmm. Every day you see it when we're making any kind of small decision. You know, it always links back to the sustainability line, and that's, I suppose, in a way, it makes it much easier. You know, you can draw a line and you can pick a path very, very quickly when your answers have to come back to, is that the most sustainable way to do it? Or is that the most sustainable source of it? You know, so I never actually thought of it like that or said it out loud. But, you know, even today making, you know, phone calls and conversations with people, when you go back to, you know, a single line or a single destination, it makes it much easier.
And in practice then, what does it mean?
In practice it means... I suppose what you do and how you do it, it's deciding factors. Hmm. You know, whether you ship or you deliver something to somebody, it can be something as simple as that. You know, is it better off using group haulage or is it better off one of our own vans going up and down? But sustainability, I suppose it's a massive, massive, massive word. Hmm. And I mean, so many things, there's so many different people. And I suppose when I first got into this, and when I first picked the name Sustainable Seafood Ireland, like, it's a big name. Mm. And it, you know, it's as much a, well, it is a mission statement. It's not just, you know, we didn't just start off with that. When I started this, I wanted the best fish. I just come back from working in Paris and London and all around the world, and I come back to Ireland and I wanted line caught and I wanted this and I wanted, you know, all the things that I'd become accustomed to everywhere else. And I got back to Ireland and it wasn't here. So, you know, even the likes of line caught, you know, I was going, right, I'm going to make sure everything's line caught. And then, you know, only through, you know, through painstaking kind of, you know, trying to search and find it, that I find out that line caught isn't something that we do widespread here in Ireland. And so from there, the journey kind of began then into, well, so if there isn't line caught, what is sustainable and what rigs are boats using and how are they fishing and, you know, how is it managed and what does manage mean and all these kind of bigger questions kind of to grow out of it. But that would, you know, and that's only a small part to do with catching the actual fish. There's everything else that's involved in it, you know, to do with the packaging and issues around packaging and transport, issues around transport, and, you know, everything down to, you know, the water, your water consumption, or just to your staff and to your staffing levels, and, you know, it's a huge topic.
We're seeing it on the investment side of it all the time. Because, as you said, it's such a large word, sustainability. It becomes very easy to greenwash these things and you know, put yourself out there. But walking the walk and talking the talk are two totally different things.
Completely. And I keep on. I was at a seminar earlier on, and I was kind of, you know, grinding my teeth, because they kept on saying sustainability. It's such a buzzword. It's not a buzzword. It's, you know, it's a real thing. So, you know, we need to take it out of, you know, in business, we often think about, or some people will think about, you know, the angle of something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an angle. It shouldn't be an angle. If you think it's an angle, well, then you need to rethink, period.
And then when it comes to dealing with your customers, you kind of, once they get comfortable with it, they have the you know, safety of knowledge that, you know, it isn't just words. They're not going to reinvent the wheel of becoming a sustainable wholesaler of fish if they can find somebody that is aligned to their way of doing things.
Absolutely, it obviously makes it easier for the consumer. When it comes to restaurants and the wholesale customers, when a fish is sustainably caught and treated and managed and handled, it's a much better product for a restaurant to use. So that's one of the drivers for restaurants. For the consumer, it can be a minefield to buy sustainable fish. We want to be sustainable, we want to be ethical, and we want transparency. And a lot of the time, especially of late, you go into a supermarket and you try and buy something, and all of a sudden you realise that, you know, the salmon you bought is actually a species from Canada that was flown across the planet, and, you know, how is it still fresh? And so many other questions come up. So I suppose it gives them, of course, align themselves with something that they can trust. But being that company that they can trust as well is obviously...
Is it a misconception that sustainable or good quality food has to be much more expensive than what people consider normal food?
Yeah, absolutely not. And I think you firsthand have experienced that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, to be sustainable when it comes to... So I can only really talk about seafood. So when it comes to be sustainable about seafood, a lot of it's about evening the keel, you know, so not only eating one species of fish and evening the balance that we have and what we take out of the ocean. And then as you go down the spectrum of fish to, you know, obviously you've got your cod and your tunas and these big predators in the water, and you move lower down the trophic scale, it's called, you know, down to the bottom feeders, you know, like on land, like to explain the trophic scale, like, so on land you have chickens, you know, they peck around the ground, and in the sea you've got like plaice or you've got mullet and things like that. That feed around the bottom. They're not eating rubbish. They're eating from the bed, and they're much more cheap. They're much more affordable, and they're much more sustainable fish. They've got larger quotas. They're more readily available. But it's also evening the balance. Mm-hmm. So no, the simple answer is no. It shouldn't be more expensive to eat sustainably. Obviously, when there's artisan fishing methods brought in, like, you know, there's line caught and finger lining and, you know, line and pole and all these kind of really, really super low impact, like Kirk fishing, for example, super low impact, incredible Irish historic way of fishing that was almost lost up until recently. You will pay a slight premium for it. But you know why you're paying the premium.
Yeah. And you're happy to pay the premium, because that's what it is. But you raise an interesting point when you look at, you know, Irish people in general. We're all willing, when we go abroad, we'll eat any fish, right? We don't even know what it is because it's called something different or anything like that. Perfectly willing to eat a wide variety of fish and seafood when we're on holidays. But when we get back home, we aren't. It has to be this, has to be that.
I don't agree with that. Okay. I think a lot of restaurateurs, a lot of chefs, a lot of pubs are afraid some of the time to put something else on the menu. They think that Mary only wants cod and Jim he'll only have haddock. You know, that's not the case. Mary and Jim have actually travelled the world. They're really well read. They're really well, educated around food. They love eating and they know their product. So to give, you know, either one of those demographics a lovely piece of pollock or a lovely piece of gurnard, they'd be absolutely delighted with it, and they're used to having it abroad. It just takes a bit of courage from our side not to put cod on the menu all the time, or not to put hake on the menu all the time.
Not to go for the lowest common denominator every single time.
Exactly. Just go outside the box a little bit. And, you know, restaurants are always, the margin is so tight in restaurants. While I know everyone thinks restaurants are so expensive, you know, your margin for error is so slight, whether you make money or you lose a ton of money. And when you make money, you only make a small bit. When you lose money, you lose massively.
It's big, yeah.
So they're worried about bringing in fresh, super fresh stock, like a fish that hasn't got the shelf life that a dry good has, or the beef or lamb have, where it could actually, you know, benefit from age. Whereas fish in the traditional restaurant setting is just, you know, it has to be in today and gone tomorrow. Type thing. Unless you buy off us, of course, and then you've got loads of time and it's super fresh.
Switching to the business, and you know, I mentioned that this was one, you know, meeting you was one of the COVID learnings for me, but there's an old saying in business that change happens when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change, right? And COVID hit your business in terms of the restaurants and the supplying of restaurants pretty hard. But you made a big pivot, and you know, it was a very brave pivot you made. Now, some would say it might have been out of necessity, but you still had to make that change.
It was totally out of necessity. In the restaurants, I knew that it wouldn't work. My food, you know, high-end seafood, cooked, prepared, ready to go, doesn't travel well.
Yeah.
So I knew that wasn't going to be a runner for me. And I knew if I opened and closed, to open that kind of machine and close that kind of machine again and again, you just lose tons of money. I know this from my 30 years in the business. So I took the decision in the beginning that I wasn't going to open. I'll wait until we were fully open and I could open securely and safely, and I knew that I could. So I did that. On the wholesale side of it, we had fish in stock when we closed. And then when we opened, we had stock. And then we closed. Then we opened and we closed. And I suppose when we first really closed down, I had this stock there, and I actually had COVID myself at home at the time, and it was a necessity thing. It was like, how am I going to get rid of this? And while sick in bed, I made the website. It was I can't remember the name of them now. It's a very easy kind of, you know, website you make at home type thing to sell a couple of bits of fish, and saw that I could sell a couple of bits of fish, and I saw some there that it developed into the multitude of things then that it became during COVID, as we pivoted and repivoted and repivoted.
And like, to be fair, I think, you know, as you said, there are plenty of well-educated consumers out there that are all the time looking for different things, and you were kind of to a certain extent knocking an open door for them, because they were in the same position that they were at home, they weren't maybe working from home, and that they had the time to be trying stuff, as I had, that suddenly you could go up to you guys and you had some very, very well-educated fishmongers there that would be able to go, try a bit of this, try a bit of that, something else.
It was great. It was an amazing experience. I'd never dealt with the public like that. To the fish side of it, to restaurants, of course. I suppose we try to marry most of, if not everyone that works in SSI, they're all chefs, or they're all from restaurants, or as they're front of house, they're managers. So they always knew the industry and they understand hospitality. And it was so exciting for us to bring out all of our wares. Literally, you know, when you've been there, we empty the entire fridge out and put out the floor in these fish boxes and have people coming in, rummaging through fish and going to go, well, I'll have this, I'll have that. And it was so exciting for us. I think it was exciting for the customer coming in as well. And it just showed us this whole other market, this whole other side. You know, Irish people, you know, like, we are a nation of foodies at this stage. You know, you literally couldn't throw a stone without hitting a foodie. And during COVID, you know, there was a hunger and a need, but there's also a massive hunger and need to support local business and local food businesses. And that really shone through to me. It was touching. You know, I think you saw it at one stage. I think we did like a 2.5 hour queue outside the wholesale. We did a 2.5 hour queue down St. Anne's Park of people willing just to come out and just to support. So,
and in the same way you were supporting the fishermen and the trawlers that you had sourced from all the time.
Absolutely.
Because they needed to earn a living.
They did. And they kept on fishing, whether you wanted them or not. They were out and landing fish. So, it was great, because obviously the export market had closed and everything had closed, and it just meant that we had this massive bountiful supply here. You know, at stages we were buying like, you know, 1,000 kilos of lobsters, and it was a tenner of lobster, and everyone was, you know, all of a sudden we're all in COVID, we're all having lobster barbecues, which is brilliant though. You know, it was great that we got to enjoy, you know, and see, you know, for everyone, you know, Joe's hope to enjoy the bounty of our island.
And do you think that's carried on? Do you think that's brought in a whole, you know, going back to the question I was asking you about the people, Irish people eating a wider variety, because they actually, has that continued on?
100%. I think we do eat a wide variety. I think now a lot of people know that there's more available there. I think there was a shift though. Like, so during, like, pre-COVID, we were very much focused, I think, as a consumer, about supporting local small artisan producers, small suppliers, and, you know, from restaurants to all the way down the chain to the regular consumer on the street, was really, really focused on that and loved seeing the names and the menus. So when COVID hit, everyone jumped on that and supported those, you know, ourselves, amazing, McNally's Farm, Sean Hussey, all these people, everyone jumped in and really helped, you know, the small suppliers like us, which is amazing. When we came out of COVID, we came into a cost of living crisis, which that meant all of a sudden, I think people had no choice but to shift from, you know, buying at food markets, this kind of thing, where it will cost it a little bit more, to kind of go, oh, I need to go back to the grocery shopping. So there was that kind of shift, up until very recently. I think it's begun to shift back now towards that, because, you know, the supermarkets are now so expensive that it now makes more sense to go back to the small producer.
Do you think you've had or was the retail move the sliding door moment for the business, or has there been others?
When we made a big change, that would be the biggest change that we've ever made. And I suppose, people kind of look back and, you know, ask me all the time, you know, oh, it was amazing what happened during COVID, and if you were to go back and do it again, would you do the same thing again? And the answer is, I don't know. Like, on one hand, if I had sat on my hands and did nothing, the business would probably be more profitable now. But on the other hand, we got this exposure that 30 years wouldn't have given us. Well, you know, in a lot of places, now, it may be mainly Dublin, and in certain circles in Dublin, but it's a household name. People know it, and they know the brand, and they know, you know, and to get that's amazing. So I suppose it's whether we do it again or not. Was this sliding door moment? Yeah, 100%. We went from zero back to maybe 10% under what we were turning over. Okay. So that was huge.
Huge, yeah.
You know, to what took us years to build, you know, we did overnight, basically. But now I suppose, now, like, so when we reopened, it was very hard. Like, so we were doing markets on the side of the street, literally driving vans down the side of alleyways.
Remember?
And, you know, and like myself or some other poor suffering staff who just wanted to work, would jump out and would start filleting fish on the side of the road. From that to food trucks to obviously the wholesale markets and villages, and it was crazy. We were doing so many different things. Then when the wholesale opened back up, you know, we had to gear back up. We were trying to do both, and we couldn't do both successfully. You know, you just couldn't put all that together. It would have been amazing if we would have doubled our business overnight. So now what we're trying to do is trying to see how to balance that so that we can retain, you know, some of the, you know, the learnings, mainly because we learned so much by shifting our business into these new models. And it's by trying to bring those new models back into the existing successful business and branching from there.
Do you obsess about the small things in business?
No.
No.
No, life's too short. the devil's in the detail, but if I obsessed over all the small details, I wouldn't be able to move forward, and, you know, you just get caught up in it. I think for me, it's a physical business that's constantly moving and changing and turning, and you need to, you know, take the learnings from them and find the solution. Like, you know, if you see the problem and look at the problem, you're only going to have a problem. But if you recognise the problem and then look for the solution, you're only going to find a solution.
And when you finished your training as a chef, was it always a plan to end up with a business empire like this, or was it, were you, you know, strictly going to say to yourself then, restaurants, own my own restaurant, and then that's the kind of end of it?
Yeah, like, so I trained as a chef while still in school.
Right.
And then when I left school, then I went off to university to do a degree in hotel management. I did the chefing part of it initially was because my dad, the only bits of advice my dad ever gave me, because he was in the restaurant business as well, was make sure you can take the chef's apron
So you'll always have a job.
So you're never stuck.
Yeah.
A lot of restaurateurs don't have the experience in the kitchen. So if a chef leaves or a chef's sick, you know, that's it. Your business has to close. Mm. Whereas for someone that can cook and is trained, it doesn't. You go in and you dictate your menu and you control your menu and you ultimately control your restaurant and business. The dream was always just to own restaurants. That was always the end goal. Beyond that, the rest has been, you know.
And how do you feel about where the business is now in terms of the progress that it's made? Are you proud of it?
I'm very proud of it. Yeah. I'm extremely proud. More than anything. I love my restaurants, and they've done amazingly, and they've won all the awards, and they're brilliant. And I love them because I love being in them. I love cooking in them. I love the atmosphere and all the rest of it. SSI. It's coming on 10 years this year, and it's been amazing. It was an accidental business. I never meant for it to become something, and the goal still now isn't for it to be the biggest, but it is, and the goal has always been for it to be the best at what we do, and now I know so much more and I see so much more, and with that, you know, comes the headache of, you know, the more you know, the more you see, the more you need to fix, the more you need to change and grow, like, so.
And it is, you raise an interesting point, because oftentimes what you find with a lot of companies is that with success comes the risk of distraction, and suddenly you're kind of going, oh well, we could go over here, we could do this, we could do that, trying to grow the business or expand the business, but not get distracted by fool's errands is always a difficult thing to do.
It is, and like, I mean, I think COVID taught me that lesson, you know, really, really, really quick, because, you know, we were doing so many different things because we didn't know what to do and had to reinvent the business. And it wasn't just, you know, in one way. We did, you know, obviously with online and with markets and with, you know, just all these different, you know, retail packs and all these different things. A lot of the time we were as busy as fools because, you know, we were taking the learnings. And then when the wholesale reopened back up was when one of the staff actually turned around and goes, we can't do it all. Mm. And, you know, it was so true. So that's when we had to cut back to what we knew we could do and do really, really well. And then, and that's where we're at now. It was amazing one way because we got to try, you know, five or six different things for
in a nice little incubator almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was an incubator, even down to our seafood suppers, all these things. They were like little incubators. And now we're beginning to, you know, to separate them out and kind of go, you know, and look at them and kind of go, right, well, you know, we're doing A, B and C now. These could be the next, you know, the next moves along the line, but we don't need to be busy fools to do it. We know we've a good idea of what will work and what won't work. So
the other question, I suppose, that's interesting now, post-COVID, you know, the restaurants, as you say, have reopened. You better throw a shout out as to what the two names of the restaurants
are. So the Seafood Cafe on Farron Street, just beside Central Bank, is the one that's open at the moment. And then Claw, which was the original kind of seafood shack in Temple Bar, hasn't reopened yet. We've just found a new premises for it. So we're hoping to reopen that at the end of the summer.
Very good.
So that's them, yeah.
But I suppose the big question that we're seeing in a lot of places is obviously, you know, we're seeing restaurants close because they can't get staff, can't get all of those things. Do you see the restaurants being a smaller part of the pie going forward because of those industry issues, you know, in 5 years' time? Or do you think, you know, the nature of them, there'll always be a demand for them and you can continue?
No, I think there'll always be a demand for them. Right. I think we'll continue. We're very lucky. We've an amazing team. And because during COVID, I transferred a lot of the staff that wanted to stay working from the restaurants directly onto the wholesale. Like Philly, who you know, who's our F&B manager for the restaurants, got heavily involved in the wholesale and then moved back into the restaurant. So we've been very lucky that we retained staff all during COVID, and we actually grew our staffing during COVID. We tripled our staffing during COVID. So when we reopened, we had a team of people ready to go into it. Finding chefs was extremely difficult. Mm. The first few months of the restaurant was really, really hard. So I was back cooking every day, which is tough.
I'm getting soft.
I am getting soft. I used to be like a knife wielding, you know, pirate in the kitchen, like, and now I don't know what I'm like, Captain Birdseye.
Yeah.
It's a hard job.
Yeah.
You know, you're on your feet all day long. It's backbreaking. You know, it has its rewards, of course, but it's a tough graft. But I think you know, in the industry itself has improved dramatically. Over the years, it's improved day on day, 100%. It's amazing. And even now, since COVID, the work-life balance, people aren't willing to do what we would have done previously. And, you know, they've, you know, and chefs are, you know, very single-minded, most of us are anyway, and have kind of said, no, I'm not going to do, you know, five doubles in a row. And a double, for anyone that doesn't know, starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, 8 o'clock most places, and you'd probably walk out at 1 o'clock in the morning. That's all day long, that's on your feet, that's not taking a break, that's not having your 11s or having a cup of coffee or, you know, sitting down. That's you grafting, like, physically all day. People aren't willing to do that, and rightly so. Which is great. So there's more of a work-life balance, and employers have realised that they need to have, you know, that work-life balance, and they need to give their staff these things.
Yeah.
You know, we were lucky that we always had that, or we always aimed for that anyway, because I'm a chef and I couldn't ask someone to do what I was, what I didn't want to do. So,
on the matter of training our staff and training, do you find it's better to train your own or parachute people in?
Train my own.
Train your own.
Yeah, it's very personalised what we do in the restaurants, especially because it's my food and it's my recipes, and you know it's the touch when it comes to cooking seafood. You know, it can only be shown by someone who, you know, by me, I suppose, or by Lucas or by Philly or someone that know what I mean, like, that really know it and have spent time in it. The wholesale is a little bit different. You can parachute people in, you know, somebody bringing in them for knife skills and for filleting techniques, and, you know, for HACCP and things like that. You can definitely bring people in, and there's a broader range of supports and people there that you can bring in. Whereas in my own particular restaurants, it's so specialised that if we do it ourselves, it saves ourselves, and then I get to spend more time with the staff then as well, so the kind of culture continues.
The experiment, if you will, with Philly being able to move from the restaurant, front of his restaurant, to doing the wholesale, as you think going forward, is that something that you could be offering to other people that you know, that suddenly they would never have thought of the wholesale side of the business? And
yeah, absolutely, 100%. It's something that they would love to do. Like, Philly's amazing, and he's with me many, many years, and it was great for him to come in, and Philly learned how to fillet, and he's literally a full-fledged fishmonger, and he can, you know, he can do all the bits and understands everything to do with the fish. But he also got to see the business side of it, and the office side of it, and the invoicing side of it, and, you know, the web side of it, and the e-commerce side of it, and it was a whole new range of skills the skills he already had, but learning to apply them in a different method was brilliant. And it's something there that's open to all the staff to come in and to see and to understand, and vice versa. It's great for the fishmongers and for the lad to go back into restaurants, even though that's where they're from originally. It's great for them to be able to get back in. And I suppose with Salty Boy, our food truck, we got to do that because the lads get to still cook and create in our production kitchens there, and the same as the floor staff get to, and the restaurant staff get to leave and go out in sight, and, you know, so it's a dynamic.
You mentioned there that your dad gave you some advice when you're looking at the restaurant. Who do you seek advice from when you're coming to the business?
I suppose my dad has always been my first point of call.
Right.
He owned restaurants in Dublin for decades, and they were great and amazing, and some ended great and some didn't end great. So he's seen both sides of the spectrum, so it was always great. Other than that, like, in the wholesale side of it, I tried to lean on BIM and other organisations like that to try and get the skill base and to get the understanding of what I needed. But most of it was trial and error. If I was to go back and do it all again, I would obviously do it completely differently than I did the first time around. But,
and then in that vein, what was your biggest mistake, do you think, you made along the way?
The biggest mistake I made along the way, finance, not knowing, not understanding finance. If I was to go back and do university or college again, I would do finance, and then I'd do a master's in my chosen career. And that's the advice I try and give my children now.
Well, it's interesting. That's the next question I have. What advice would you give to, you know, your younger self is obviously do that, but would it be the same to give advice to young people in general now?
Yeah.
Understand that broad the discipline.
Understand the finance, meaning like business and being, you know, an entrepreneur, if you want to call it, or being a business owner. Like, everyone says, you know, you need so many hats. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did do a degree and I did qualify as a chef and I did do PR and marketing as separate diplomas and things like that. So I was always building my arsenal. Finance is one part of it that I always thought I could just trust to accountants mm-hmm. and things, but you really can't, yeah. you know, because, you know, there's no offense to any accountants. There's a lot of them out there and, you know, they're not all the same. And some are really good, and having that knowledge and that experience, to, you know, for the really good financial advice and, you know, clever savings, you know, I think it's something we should all be doing now. Mm. You know, it should be a core subject in schools.
But it also means, you know, like finance in and of itself is important, but you have to be able to apply it with the knowledge of the business that you're looking at, and that's the key, you know. Yeah. You mention it and you do. See, you know, you have no fear of going back and running the line in the kitchen if you ever had to, for a short period of time anyway.
No, I love it. And to be honest, if I had more time, I find most of my time now is spent on emails, to be honest with you. And God, I hate them so much.
Yeah. Paper cuts are worse than knife cuts.
You know, they really are. I know how to wield a knife a lot better than I do a keyboard. But I still try and do one day a week in the kitchen where I'll go in and cook with the guys. We'll try new specials and we'll get to hang out. Ultimately, I'm in the business because I love hospitality and I love interacting with customers, and in the Seafood Cafe and in Claw, you know, you're up, you know, there is no barrier between the kitchen and the floor. Chefs serve, we all talk to customers all the time, so you get to cook for somebody and then put it down in front of them and then see the reaction in real time, and you know, it's self gratification, I suppose, but it's
what percent of the success of the business would you say is due to luck and what's due to hard work?
I would say 80-20.
Luck, 80% luck.
No, graft. 80% hard work and 20% has been being I have been really lucky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I've been really lucky with you know, media and press have been a massive part of my success. I suppose that's been, you know, That was just luck. That just came along. But it helped, you know, promote the business, you know. But most of it's graft, I think.
I suppose, given the nature of the restaurant business in general, right, and it's in a lot of cases, you know, short lifespan for large parts of it. To what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you in the business?
Massive. Failure is never an option. I've always self-funded everything that I've done, so it's always been my money that's done it, and I just don't do failure. Not into it. I have failed before. I've had businesses that, you know, that haven't worked. But I suppose anyone who's I'm self-employed since I'm 21. I'm 36. I wish. I'm 46 now. They haven't all worked out. Fear of failures. Yeah, it is a massive driving force. Yeah.
If somebody was to ask you what the culture is in the company, in the organisation, what would you say are the couple of key tenets of the culture?
I don't know.
You know, like, why do people come to work for you?
Why do people come to work for us? I suppose honesty will be a big part of it. The honesty, like in every way, there is no hierarchy. Everyone's treated I'd like to think that everyone's treated like an individual, like an adult. Everyone's respected and given the respect that they deserve. Nothing has to be earned. It's all there. It's all deserving. Yeah. You know, trying to just be super fair. Like, I've always done it. Like, I mean, back in the 90s and things like that, when I was working for other people, you know, there are so many not nice people out there. Really, really mean, nasty people. And I swore that I'd never be like them. And when I had my own place, that I would have a place that I would want to be in and I would be proud of. So I'd be proud to do any job inside any of my businesses. From my KP, who's, you know, amazing, brilliant, the backbone of any restaurant, to, you know, to the managers, to the filleters, to everybody. And I do them, like in the beginning when we first opened the Seafood Cafe, again after COVID, we couldn't find a kitchen porter. Mm. So I had to bring my partner Natalie in to work on the floor, and I went in and cooked, and then the two of us washed up every night. Mm. And this is only recently, you know what I mean? And, you know, I think just and willingness
do you think, to do that. Do you think the customers can sense that? Do you think that that collegiality is sensed?
I do think it is, yeah.
And adds to the ambience within a restaurant.
100%. Like we had a secret diner in recently doing, you know, a secret dining thing, and sent us a report on it. And, you know, it was lovely to read it back, because it was so positive and it was so good, and they were completely independent to us. We didn't hire them. Somebody else hired them. So it was amazing to kind of read it back. But one of the things that kind of came true was how happy the staff were, how they all got on, how much they knew about the individual product, and how proud they were, you know, the sense of ownership that they all had over it.
That's really key.
Oh, it's incredible. Like, you know, it's incredible. So, you know, we're a very small structure, you know, and company that don't really, you know, they don't really, I suppose we need to look at more why and what our culture is, the culture that we have.
I suppose final question on the business. As you look at the wholesale side of the business, Is that trend to sustainability, is you know, as we come out of COVID and things like that, are more and more restaurants looking at that kind of, you know, wanting to be able to trace the quality of what they're serving and be able to go, because ultimately I'm sure the customers are coming in and going, well, we'd like to know what we're eating.
Yeah, I don't think the customers ask nearly enough when they're in restaurants. We've been going to ask more when we're in supermarkets, which is amazing, and that's what filters through to the restaurants. Coming out of it, yeah, I do. There's a massive proactiveness in restaurants, and especially hotel groups, which was a market we never looked at before, and now we're quite involved in it, where they want to, like, they're really out to do better, because they know that the small changes they make are actually quite big. Yeah. They're huge. So there's these great hotels and hotel groups who have this structure in place so that everyone can experience it, everyone can feel it, everybody can understand it. That's really exciting seeing that, and, you know, it's really exciting seeing that now.
Yeah. Final question. We have a tradition here that the last guest has written the question for you. I have no idea the question is, but I'm going to tell you.
Go for it. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, this is a good one. What is the biggest sacrifice you've had to make to achieve your business goals, and is there one big regret?
I suppose it's family time, and time for yourself, making time for yourself. I've been lucky, and I've always tried to balance it. But I missed years, or not even, you know, I'd still be at all the events and I'd still go to all the things and, you know, all that stuff, but not being there in the moment, you know, having my phone on all the time, or having my emails on my phone all the time. I have 4 different emails, and I can't tell you how many hundreds of emails a day, having them there and constantly looking at them, so you're never really engaged in the moment. I think only since COVID did I realise, because everyone took a break, and I kept working, and then everyone started working, and then it was only then that I realised that I had missed an opportunity to step back, and I had missed an opportunity. So now, come 5 o'clock, I turn off all my emails. My WhatsApp has a outgoing message saying basically piss off until tomorrow, and so that's the mistake that I made, but that's one that I'm trying to correct now. So I suppose I'm lucky that I can see the folly.
Very good. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Niall Sabongi, for all of his insights. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.